This is Thrive Perspectives, an ever-growing discussion about the issues and ideas that shape our lives with your guide, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Hi there, Thrive Perspectives family. Before we dive into this episode, I want to provide some background on what, or rather who, much of the discussion will draw from. In this episode, we delve into how we think and its intersection with our Christian worldview. We'll be exploring the extensive work of British psychiatrist and neurologist Ian McGilchrist. If you want to search up Ian, his name is spelled I-A-I-N McGilchrist, M-C-G-I-L-C-H-R-I-S-T. Ian has authored numerous books and papers, with his latest publication being the two-volume work The Matter with Things, which was released in November 2021. This work serves as a sustained critique of reductive materialism, addressing questions such as, who are we? What is the world? What is the nature of time and space? What do we mean by purpose, value, and the divine? And how do we most reliably set about finding out? Now, despite being raised in a Christian home and being familiar with Christian theology, McGilchrist states that he has no religious affiliation. He perceives God as both immanent and transcendent, existing within and beyond all things. And while he openly criticizes religious exclusivism, he regards the spiritual quest as precious and critically important. McGilchrist states that his concept of God is both undeniable and inscrutable. He emphasizes the necessity of speaking about God, even though much of what we say may miss the mark. So throughout this episode of Perspectives, you'll hear us reference McGilchrist's work, among others. We'll also include links to these references in the podcast notes, so check those out at the end of the podcast. Alrighty, let's jump into this episode of Perspectives with Matt and Connell. Good morning, Connell. Good morning, Matt.
Morning, lads.
It's getting chilly in here.
Yeah, well, we had the heater on this morning for the first time, I think, actually. Yeah. So, yeah.
We'll warm it up with a bit of brisk conversation today, lads, for sure.
And a bit of hot air.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
and I'm excited because you finally let me, Stu, focus on something that I've been wanting to focus on for a while, that I think is an absolute game changer in so many respects. And I wanted to wait till I was sort of ready. I've been getting my head around this. I'm actually preparing a seminar that I'm doing at the college based on the work of this philosopher, psychiatrist called Ian McGilchrist. And I've mentioned this before to you guys. Yeah. I've said, we've got to do something on this because I think it's an absolute game changer.
That's good. Well, let's do something on it. Welcome to Thrive Perspectives. This could be a long episode, so strap yourselves in. And Matt, let me hand over to you and you introduce this topic because I know this is one that you've been really keen to talk about.
So I came across a little while ago, and I've been reading through stuff, the work of Ian McGilchrist. Before that, actually, what sort of got me onto this was reading Oliver Sacks, and you guys might be aware of the work of Oliver Sacks, and some of our listeners might be. There was a movie called Awakenings with Robert De Niro, and it was actually Oliver Sacks is the doctor sort of involved in that. And anyway, he dealt with sort of brain injuries, and there's a famous book that he published called The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, as weird as that sounds. But, you know, the book is about the effects of brain injury and the strange reality that injuries to the brain can create, that there are certain injuries to the brain, particularly strokes and so forth, that completely alter the way you can be personality altering, but particularly alter the way that people experience reality. And, you know, Oliver Sacks in his writings, I mean, he sort of asks more questions and he's looking very much at treatment. But it was actually Ian McGilchrist's work that goes much more into this, and the field has been much more developed, and he sums up a lot of the research on the way that the brain processes reality. And I think this is an interesting topic because, you know, in everything that we talk about, our brains are involved in some sense filtering reality through us. And so I think it matters for us how the brain actually does that.
And it filters that reality different for you than for me. So I might see something a certain way, you see something a completely different way.
Yeah, that's right. And And this is what the work of McGilchrist actually helps to explain somewhat. And so basically his work focuses on hemisphere differences, and we just need to put aside some of the old stuff that the, you know, the kind of right brain is creative and left brain is mathematical. There's something, there is some truth to that, but I think what he presents is a sort of updated, presents all the updated research on this. And there's a famous book, and might be worth starting with the leading metaphor that he uses in a book that became very famous called The Master and His Emissary. And he uses the metaphor of the two halves of the brain as a master and his emissary. And in essentially, the right brain is the part of the brain that is open to reality and has an immediate experience of reality in its wholeness, you know. But then the left brain is like the personal computer of the right brain. It creates a representation of reality and sort of breaks it up and analyzes it. So it creates a sort of a closed world in a sense, and then it sort of analyzes that. So it's a little bit another illustration is, you know, the left brain creates a kind of map, an abstract map. If you think of the difference between looking out at a beautiful valley and then looking at a map of that valley, that's essentially the sort of difference between sort of what the hemispheres do.
Well, he talks about that as the left brain creates representations of things. So like the map idea is one of them. Another one is like music.
Yeah.
You know, you could take music and you can reduce the whole thing down to, well, it's just, that's an A and that's a B flat and that's a...
And the intervals and the mathematics of it.
Yeah, you can write it all down. Now, the process of going from a piece of music to writing it all down as what the actual notes are that goes into making it, you end up with two completely different things. Music moves you in ways that you can't even understand, listening to amazing music being played.
Yeah.
It does something for you.
Yeah.
That's why humans, we love music. We're drawn to it. We want to hear it.
Yeah.
But when we distill it down into the parts, which is just the A's and the B's,
yeah, so you wouldn't know, Connell.
I don't really get into the letters of the alphabet too much. But
it's very true, actually, because by over-analyzing a piece of music. I mean, I've had this experience where I've sort of over-analyzed a piece of music, and it has ceased to have the effect that the previous experience of the wholeness of it, that fresh experience of the piece of such, has ceased to have because I've broken it up into little bits.
Mm.
And so you lose the wonder of the whole, in a sense, and the effect of the whole.
Yeah, well, what something really is more than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
So we can take something and reduce it down into the parts, but just the parts in themselves, even if you put all the parts back together, you don't end up with what it was. Like, it's more than that.
Yeah.
Like, and so the process of trying to capture something or grasp something and distill it down into something that we can understand, we start categorizing things, breaking it down, decontextualizing things and so on. And so we end up with some kind of representation of what it was, but we actually lose the wholeness of it, which McGilchrist then goes on to talk about, that it's not so much that it's a machine to be broken down, but it's more based on its relationships. You actually lose things. It's what's in between the parts, I think, is the way he sort of describes it. It's in the space in between that there's something that's kind of intangible in all of these things, that it's more than just the parts in themselves. I think, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's an age of reductionism, in other words. We're just trying to reduce everything down to what we can understand.
Yeah, and essentially, this is what, this is in this illustration of the master and his emissary, you know, the left brain is that sort of computational side part of our thinking, where it's essentially it creates a representation of it, and it dissects the bit. So it's the part of the brain that dissects and creates categories and separates things. And so it's very mechanistic, and it's quite instrumentalist as well. Like, it breaks things down. It's very practical. It's all about use and what can be done with these things. So
it's probably kind of where AI's at right now, really, because it can do some of that stuff.
In a way, yes,
coming
that's
out of that
right.
conversation, yeah, yeah. they can do the mathematical right. calculations,
but it works with reality as a closed system. So the reality for the left brain is that representation, you know, that representation in a sense. So the interesting stuff, and this is both from Oliver Sacks and Ian McGilchrist, is the effects actually of right brain stroke or even in experimental circumstances where they can sort of temporarily disable the right brain and how reality, you know, depicts itself. There's, you know, famous example, and I can't remember if it's McGilchrist or Oliver Sacks. I think they both present examples like this where because if you disable the right brain, then the left brain attends to the, you know, like the different halves, like your right brain controls the left half of your body and your left brain controls the right half of your body. So if the right brain often is shut down, the interesting thing there is that they actually can only even see the left, you know, the left aspect of reality.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they're eating a meal, they'll only eat on the left side of the plate or they'll only really know or see the left part of their body. And, you know, in case of a stroke, you know, they lose control of the right half of their body. And McGilchrist gives the example of, showing a patient like their right arm and, what is this? And they just deny that it's even theirs, you know, it's almost tantruming if it belongs to the guy in the next bed or something, or that's your arm. It's not, you know, and they can't actually, you know, reality closes down and they can't really accept anything outside of the reality as it's been represented to them.
Yeah.
That's one weird effect of that. Another weird effect is that when the right brain has been shut down, that everything becomes mechanistic. People become in some sense not persons but objects. And, you know, patients with right brain stroke, you know, can feel like, you know, the nurses are robots and you know, weird things like that.
Yeah. Well, he mentioned too about schizophrenia, that people who are suffering from that particular condition, because McGilchrist is a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
So he is an expert in these things. And so, but from his observations and so on, that it's people who are suffering from that, it's usually some sort of damage to the right side of the brain, and you actually get a flow-on effect of that, where they do view things as very black and white, matter of fact. It's easy to feel threatened to, like everything's everybody else's fault, and people are attacking. And it, without that balance of the right side, the nature of how you process things through the left side creates some sort of ultra-stimulated, hyper-aware, anxious sense of reality, because everything's taken out of context of the bigger picture.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And so,
and the flip side of that would be hallucinogenic drugs that do the opposite thing, where it elevates the right-hand side of the brain and, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's an interesting area. And for anyone that's seen How to Change Your Mind, the documentary on, you know, Netflix, where essentially it, you know, the drugs completely open up the mind, and I think what that demonstrates, and this is one thing that McGilchrist points out, is that reality for us is what it is because of the way that we attend to it. So our attention kind of creates the reality by the choices that we make of what to attend to. So this is, and I think this is getting closer now to why this matters for us, as in terms of, you know, thinking through Christian worldview and the way that we see the world, particularly with respect to the broader spiritual realities that we've been discussing. Certain ways of attending, in a way, activate certain parts of the brain, and culturally, we can favor certain ways of attending, because there's a bit of a group dynamic as well. You know, we can train ourselves in a sense to attend or to block out certain things. And McGilchrist's sort of thesis in The Master and His Emissary is that in our culture, the the master has in some way become subservient to the left brain, which is meant to be the emissary. So the computer part of the brain that creates this representation has taken charge in a sense and has said, no, no, this is reality, and works with reality to close system. Now, this idea of reality as a closed system should be very familiar to us. This is the reality of the, you know, people like Dawkins and that, you know, these people that work with this sort of positivistic worldview where there's just physical reality and that's all there is. And that's sort of very closed and that, you know, those who declare the universal competency of science, you know, science can deal with every aspect of reality. It's a view known as scientism. Well, I mean, McGilchrist's point is that that scientism is actually a sort of a left brain tantrum in a sense. It's just shutting out, because the thing with the left brain, and again, they know this from the clinical research and, you know, from, you know, stroke victims, is there's a sense of certainty that comes. The left brain has this sort of certainty about its own worldview because it creates this representation, and that can all be grasped and seen, and it all makes sense.
Well, it has to make it certain, otherwise it can't process it.
Exactly.
You can't have, well, it could be two or three. No, it's either got to be two or three.
Yeah,
so
that's
make
right.
a choice, and that's what it
exactly.
is. And then we process everything because it's two.
That's right. So the left brain is very, very sure of itself, mm-hmm. you know, and it's indignant if you know, if anything, well, anything outside of this is just stupid. It doesn't make sense. And in a sense, what McGilchrist is saying is that our society, very scientifically oriented society, and a society, and there's plenty of philosophical critique on this, that has what Adorno and Horkheimer, the philosophers that came up with something that now we know as critical theory, you know, they critique the sort of instrumentalist view of reality, instrumental reason they refer to it as. It's a type of reasoning that makes everything into tools basically. And so this is the critique, is that our culture, and as I said, this has been diagnosed, you know, in plenty of other areas of philosophy, is this approach to reality that reduces everything to objects and to objects that we can use. Well, McGilchrist's point is that this is a classic left brain thing. This is us giving predominance to the left brain and leaning on the left brain certainty, and getting to the point where we're not willing to recognize something as knowledge unless we have that level of certainty.
Just to be, because I think this is important that everyone understands left brain and right brain and that difference, because he's also not dismissing the left brain. The left brain he describes is like the computer for the right brain.
Yeah.
So the right side of the brain understands things intuitively.
Yeah.
He also calls it like implicit knowledge. It's implied. We don't know why it's true necessarily, but we just sort of know that.
Yeah,
some things are true, not just making things up, but we know there's certain things about reality, and we all live that way. We all live with an intuitive knowledge that people care for us or love us, or that relationships are valid, or that people are valuable. We intuitively, we know there's something in music.
And it's not fuzzy either. Let me say this. It's not a fuzzy knowledge. It's actually a more immediate knowledge. So it's the difference between me looking at you and seeing an object and experiencing a person. And the point is that the right brain, it has a wholeness to it. Mm-hmm. It experiences the whole thing. So yes, there is. So, you know, so for example, even like with left brain stroke, or if the left brain is disabled, you're still able to function fairly well. You know what I mean? Like now there are particular functions that become difficult then, mm-hmm. but you still experience a person as a person, for example, because the wholeness, element of wholeness is still there. And so the right brain has this, what the philosopher Charles Taylor refers to as a sort of porous relationship to reality. So intuition, when you say intuition, because I'm so aware that I think we, again, and this is part of our culture, we think, that's a wishy-washy sort of knowledge. Mm. Yeah, intuition, you know, it's like a dreamy cloud, you know. No, that's actually a much more immediate form of knowledge.
So he also uses an example, I think this conveys it quite powerfully, from an evolutionary sense, where you're going and hunting and you know, grabbing hold of prey.
Yeah.
You're focused on just, you know, the prey that you're trying to grab hold of to feed you. And so that's in front of you and you know you're just sort of creeping up on it and you're just focused on grabbing hold of it. But there's another part of you that's also aware of your environment all around you of what might be creeping up on you. So you don't become someone else's prey. But all your focus and attention is on grabbing hold of the thing that's right in front of you that you need to grab hold of. But there's this other kind of like much bigger, much more complicated world around you that's actually coming for you as well. And you somehow have to be aware of all these layers of things that are happening that the left brain can't possibly cope with that. It can only cope with that immediate thing that's in front of you now. And that's the point that he makes with the right brain. The right brain deals with the big question, the complicated stuff, that even stuff that we can't even understand. It's right brain's happy to deal with uncertainty, ambiguity, not being able to explain everything.
Which is not lack of knowledge, I should say, because because one of the things that the left brain wants to do is pull things apart and explain everything in a logical fashion. But there are aspects of reality that we can't do that with.
Yes.
But like I can't explain, I can explain you as an object and pull you apart and dissect you scientifically, but that doesn't explain you as a person.
No. And so he actually draws between two words, which is one, there's ignorance and there's the unknowable. Yeah. And so ignorance is things that we can know, but we just don't know.
Yeah.
And then there's the unknowable, which is stuff that we don't know, but it's actually, we're not even able to know it. We don't know it in the sense of we know it at that intuitive, implicit level.
It's unanalyzable.
Yeah, we can't break it down.
Yeah. So there's two different ways.
So Thomas Aquinas makes this distinction between apprehending and comprehending reality. And I think it's really valuable because there are some things that we can apprehend but we can't comprehend. And of course, you know, Aquinas uses this in terms of God. So we can apprehend God, but we cannot comprehend God. And comprehension is essentially the act of abstracting reality, like creating a representation of reality as a snapshot, you know, and then being able to analyze that in a logical sort of sense. Now, we can do that with aspects of reality, but even then, we have to change reality. You know, we have to take a snapshot, a section of reality out, abstract it, and then sort of pull it to bits. Now there are reasons why we need to do that, okay? And in fact, this is where essentially language does that. So when we use words and we pull reality apart and it's ways of referring to aspects of reality. So, you know, language is a very left brain sort of thing. So let's not depreciate the role of the left brain. we don't need the left brain. No, we do, because it's an essential part of us communicating and so forth.
In a healthy brain, the way McGilchrist describes it is a lot of the big stuff, the big processing gets done in the right brain. And then in order, when it passes it to the left brain, for it to break down into some sort of actionable process. So there's things that get passed to it that there's information and knowledge that we can have. And if we're able to get into our left brain, then it becomes more immediate and useful to us. And it can, but it can process stuff from a logical perspective. And there's value in doing that and breaking things down into parts, but it can do work on it at that kind of computational level. And then it hands it back to the right brain. And the problem is if the right brain hands stuff to the left brain, but the left brain doesn't hand it back to the right brain, that's where he puts his finger on the problem, because then it takes a piece of knowledge and it says, oh, okay, now I've learned this and now I know all these things, you know, how clever I am. I've just got all this knowledge on this and how to do these things, and so I'll just take ownership of all of this, and it actually becomes, that's where it becomes ignorant, because it's only got a small piece of the picture, but it thinks it knows everything now.
Yeah, and this comes back down to cultural values, because again, in an environment where we value for some reason, a certain kind of certainty, which is quite true of our culture and not true of every other culture. There's a certain kind of certainty that we are willing to call knowledge, like you don't really know. It's so interesting the way that cultural environment can change the way that we experience reality. It can block certain things, and even then the way that we use language, and you know, the word knowledge tends to refer to things that we can know with certainty. So the word knowledge in our culture tends to refer to that abstract representation of reality, the map, rather than the real, you know, intuited experience. And so then when we talk about God and spiritual, that's not knowledge, that's just faith, you know, because, you know, it's not something that can be analyzed, closed system, or at least it doesn't make sense. It can't be made sense of within a closed system.
Yeah.
Or we can explain, you know, we come up with explanations that the logical left brain prefers. Than
so did this otherwise. Did this shift, you know, because have we always been like this from the start? Or, like, I'm assuming the industrial age probably had a significant impact on this, because probably that was where we realized we could do, you know, a certain action created a certain effect, and so then everything became about, if I do this, I get that. Is that where it kind of accelerated to becoming more and more focused on that side of our way of thinking? Or were there things before that?
Well, it's the thing before the industrial age, because remember, what led to the industrial age was the scientific revolution. And and essentially what the scientific revolution did is that it made reality into an object. We started to attend to reality in a different way than we did before,
right?
We moved into what, you know, philosophers refer to, which is a very commonly talked about problem in philosophy, is the subject object relationship that we have with reality. So reality is reduced to an object, and, you know, science is about understanding and, you know, manipulating that object. And so, you know, through the scientific revolution, particularly, you know, with Newton, we move from a view of reality that is very much a whole, that is imbued with mind, you know, the idea of the logos that John picks up in the first chapter of his gospel. In the beginning was the logos. It's translated there as word. You know, it was a very spiritual kind of view of reality, which interesting now, like, you know, physicists and philosophers are coming back to that now with the advent of quantum physics and, you know, so forth. And we've talked about that before, so we won't get into that now. But, you know, what Newton does is that he pictures the universe as a big machine. And so we start to think about everything in very mechanistic
cause and effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause and effect terms. Yeah. And so this, you know, so the left brain loves this, right?
Easy to process.
It's a big machine. Yeah. Now, I mean, the problem is that because the Newtonian universe makes so much sense to the left brain, and it, you know, it's so satisfying, and it kind of works as well at a certain level, not when you get to the quantum level, but it, you know, it works, and it's fairly understandable. Whereas, you know, I mean, quantum physics is so weird, and it, you know, I mean, even in schools, Newtonian physics, from what I understand, that's still taught in schools, because who the heck can understand, you know, quantum physics?
Well, and I think also we don't like the insecurity of the fact that we can't control, if we don't know something, we can't control it. And so this whole sense of, I can't deal with grey, I need black or white.
Yeah, that's right.
We don't want that tension.
I think once that revolution, scientific revolution happened, we probably became quite arrogant, because all of a sudden we started to notice how clever we were.
I can work
all these things out.
Yeah, and it was this definite, like, it was truly an important shift, and there's so much literature on this, and the shift in the way of thinking that left us thinking so much differently, not only to people at other times, but even to people in other cultures. And it does come with an arrogance. We know that. And I, you know, I mean, this spills into so many areas, even that the sort of kind of 19th century colonialist view of, you know, primitive people. Well, probably actually probably more 18th century, because by the 19th century, there was a reaction against that already in the 19th century.
Mm. Even the fact that we use the word primitive.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, by the 19th century, we're realizing already problems with this view of reality that is very mechanistic, and you know, we've created this mechanistic view of reality, and so this is where you get romanticism as a sort of a counter. Cultural movement, which is a reaction against this, and a you know, search, I think, again for the spiritual and the transcendent and the sublime, and but
which was right before the industrial revolution.
But we were stuck by then. We were stuck in a way with the and so that's happening alongside, to get to your point, Stu, that's happening alongside the industrial revolution. Mm. By which stage, you know, people had been reduced to machines and factories, and you know, and so the rise of instrumental reason was really at its zenith by the 19th century. And so, you know, in our culture, you know, the left brain had, in McGilchrist's terms, had already in a sense become the master. And there's this sort of search for the right, you know, we're sensing something's missing, you know, and so you get this cultural movement.
It's something I'd been sort of learning about as well, was up until a couple of hundred years ago, the scientific revolution. Prior to that, you know, we talked about natural philosophy.
Do you mean naturalistic? What do you mean by natural philosophy?
Before the scientific revolution, still people were dealing with some scientific concepts and things, but it was all integrated.
It was integrated, that's right.
Into something that were looked at as a whole. So you didn't have physicists and chemists and biologists. There was more of a focus on holistic learning. So those kind of scientific pursuits were more integrated into, people were doing philosophy. Philosophy was integrated with scientific kind of pursuits, along with literature and arts and things like that. And it was an integrated kind of knowledge system. And there was an appreciation of those things that are beyond what we can know. Mm. So we actually were okay with the right brain kind of thinking that, you know, we'd ponder through philosophy. We were open to all of those things. And even subjects like theology plugs into that. Yeah, we were okay with the idea of God. And so on, because we weren't so bought into the idea that we can we've become so clever that we can distill everything down into all the parts that we do in science. But then, as we started to move into scientific method, and we started we realized there's so much to know. So you actually had to specialize. You didn't study philosophy and theology at the same time as you were studying physics. You actually become a physicist. So you actually become a narrowing of.
So you separate out those.
Yeah. And so there was a natural kind of fading away of.
On the wholeness.
Wholeness of it. And I think that was important.
And it works. And this is the thing. The reason why it was so compelling is because it actually worked.
You could get answers.
Yeah.
Which otherwise you couldn't.
And there was a swivel point actually with Sir Francis Bacon, who's a British philosopher. And this is sort of at the dawn of the scientific revolution. I mean, he proposes that we stop focusing on the whole and grand theories and actually do something useful with our lives. You know. So, I mean, he's proposing an approach to science that can actually manipulate reality. What are his dates?
17th century.
My left brain wants
1618.
To know. 1618. I thought it was early 17th century. And I mean, that's important, because I think right there, that's where you start to get this, change of emphasis. And it becomes compelling, Connell, because it works, doesn't it? I mean, it really empowered. We moved out of trying to construct big grand views. We specialized and we were able to do amazing things and manipulate reality. But the problem then is that that power over reality created almost this sort of intellectual arrogance. Well, yeah. Like if that we, you know, we then wanted knowledge that could put us in a position of power in a sense.
Control.
And I mean, you know, Francis Bacon, it's this famous statement of his is, you know, knowledge is power. Mm. And it needs to empower us in a certain way. So what it does for our culture, I think, is that gives us this is where this instrumentalist view of reality. Mm. So reality is reduced to objects that we can manipulate. And this is a very left brain thing. And this is where you start to get the predominance of the left brain ways of thinking. And so then by the 1700s and 1800s, we're going into primitive cultures and so-called in inverted commas, and where, you know, with this sense of arrogance, like, yeah, you know, what, oh, your knowledge is this lesser sort of knowledge.
Let us bring you into the future. Yeah.
And it's not just theological type knowledge. No. You observe now with many of the great scientists that they're talking about philosophy in really derogatory terms, like they're actually devaluing philosophy. Where previously, with what I mentioned before about that natural philosophy, there was a respect like for philosophy, that science was a subset of philosophy. It's to deal with thinking and logic. And
well, to this day, if you do a PhD in science, you get a doctor of you get a doctorate in philosophy in science.
That's right. Yeah. So it's a subset of it. So
I remember when I graduated, because I missed the graduation with my group of PhD students from Melbourne University in the philosophy department. So I was in the graduation ceremony with the science students.
Oh, right.
and you know, you do the march up the aisle and you stand up the front while they read out your thesis topic, and all the scientists were all these really useful things.
Yeah. <You know? laughs>
and then they came to me, and I'm just this really esoteric kind of philosophical thing, and I'm sort of like, you know, my head drops as I sit. All these, you know, PhD science students are looking at me.
I'm surprised they didn't beat you up.
What is the point of you? Why are we funding this sort of, you know, why did this guy get a scholarship to do this?
Yeah, that's right. But I think there is that attitude that, it's like, well, now we've moved on beyond philosophy and now we've kind of put science at the top.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And it's that you can see it. I mean, it's kind of obvious. It's all flipped over on it.
Yeah. And that's that, you know, that's scientism. Scientism is, you know, essentially there is no reality outside of what science potentially can deal with. Okay, so that's, you know, I mean, that is classic left brain behavior. Mm-hmm. And this is what McGilchrist is getting at. And this is what this, see, this is getting to the point. This is why I think McGilchrist's work is a game changer, because I think he's diagnosing that whole way of thinking, that instrumentalist view of reality, that very closed system. And of course, you know, that closed view of reality that is expressed, for example, through atheists like Dawkins and Hitchens and so forth, is based on a closed view, what I would describe as a logical positivist view of reality that says, you know, only, you know, the world of tangible facts,
empirical evidence,
that can be understood, you know, rationally, only that is meaningful, you know. And look, by the, you know, certainly by the 70s, that had died out, because within philosophy, even the advocates, people like A.J. Ayer, who was, you know, probably the most famous logical positivist, was saying by the 70s, actually, we were completely wrong. You know what I mean? Like it sort of died out, and yet it keeps coming back. Why? Because, and this is another point that McGilchrist makes, there's an irrational certainty. Actually, that, like, because even though the left brain is the rational part of the brain, it doesn't know, it's irrational in the sense that it doesn't know where its limits are. Mm-hmm. It closes reality down. And I mean, famously, Blaise Pascal said that reason's last step is to acknowledge that there are infinite number of things that are beyond it. Now, that's a right brain perspective.
Yes.
The left brain won't see that. It's the left brain is like, and again, this is the right brain stroke patient that says, "Oh, the left side of my body doesn't exist," and won't accept that it exists.
But logically, it has to narrow, because the only thing the left brain actually knows is what the right brain has given it, and then it's reduced it down to parts that
has
decontextualized it, and it's become this kind of machine, narrow, lifeless, inanimate, valueless thing that the left brain thinks that is it. It's its boundary of knowledge, and it doesn't know any different. So as soon as the left brain usurps the right brain from trying to be the master, and it now asserts itself as the master, the result of us is an intellectual narrowing, and things become lifeless and valueless and meaningless and so on. There's all those consequences.
And this is the culture that he describes. You know, I mean, McGilchrist's sort of alarm call is that we've created a culture that empowers the left brain to the point where there's almost this kind of modern Western world psychosis that we're falling into.
And he goes in and describes that. But like what you just said, you know, we can pick that up as to what, because it's quite confronting, because he's not a Christian. He's not approaching it from that perspective. Mm. It is from an academic perspective. But what you said before, like with, you know, with Dawkins and a lot of the atheists of today, the new atheists and so on,
so new anymore.
No, but
I keep saying that because now, you know, yeah.
But I've been discredited.
Yeah, but.
And things like logical positivism, as an academic pursuit, this idea of the only thing that's really worth knowing is what can be proven through the scientific method, that may well have been pushed into the background and kind of debunked. But I think the remnant of it is actually somehow ended up in all of us.
Oh, we're stuck. We're so stuck. And I know as a pastor, the number of conversations I've had with people who just cannot get out of the closed world of their logic. It's the overthinking thing. I just keep, you know, it's the questions, how do I know if God's really there? I just can't. It's an inability to escape from the left brain's hold on them. That it's the overthinking. It just goes round and round within that closed system, and it can't escape from that closed system. It's like, whereas knowing spiritual reality, and particularly knowing God, we have to move outside of that. Mm. And if the left brain has this mastery over us and will not acknowledge anything outside of its closed world, which I think is the sort of psychosis that we're describing here, it disables ways of knowing that I think are necessary to really knowing God. And this is what I experience in my conversations with people as a pastor in our context, is this kind of thing where people just keep overthinking, and it creates this sort of feedback loop that they can't get outside of, and it creates a type of skepticism or doubt that is difficult to escape. And what's valuable about McGilchrist's work is that it shows what the sort of problem is, in a sense, that, you know, the left brain has this, gains this mastery, and it won't let go of that reality because why? This is the other important part of this, because it feels like we're God. We have created a reality, a closed reality that we can feel like we control, we understand. This is why it's difficult. This is why I think, and this is what I would add to McGill from a Christian worldview perspective to McGilchrist's work, is I think one of the reasons why the left brain reality gets stuck in the left brain is because it gives us a sense of mastery over our own reality. And this is what actually, we have this addiction to that kind of mastery. But the irony is that we become a slave to that closed system. We get locked in that closed system, and there's so much more to reality, but our minds become enslaved in that sort of closed loop.
Couple of observations from me. I mean, I would suggest, I don't know, but it would feel to me like the fact that technology is advancing so quickly is actually accelerating this whole process, because that's all very black and white. I mean, you know, we've been talking about AI and technology, and it's all you do this and that happens, and that's what does happen. There's no options on that.
Oh, yeah.
I think we also see the symptoms of that in the fact that the world is so polarized. My opinion is my opinion, and it's right. You know, the idea of nuance in any situation is now eliminated.
Point.
You know, it's like, no, these guys are the bad guys and these guys are the good guys.
Isn't it true? That's classic left brain tantruming.
Totally.
You know, we create this way that we see reality, and we cannot let go of it. And I think we see this, people's propensity, you know, I mean, it's this desire for a certain kind of certainty. And when you say in response to people that have this level of certainty, and that level of certainty, in a sense, is a symptom. You know, if you suggest, look, I don't think you can really know that with the certainty that you're expressing right now. Yeah. It's just, it's either black or it's white, and it's...
And then you become the bad person. You become, in a sense, in some cases, the enemy, you know, and this is where we see such a level of polarization, and people just can't hold in tension the fact that someone has a different opinion.
Well, yeah, that's right. And the thing is, it's quite removed, because it's all based on stuff out there, because, you know, there might be listeners thinking, hang on, but you know, can't we have certainty about God? But here's the key thing. It's a different kind of certainty. It's actually a different kind of knowledge to that closed loop style certainty. And this is the problem that I'm describing, because people think, unless I have that kind of certainty, that left brain certainty, I actually don't recognize it as knowledge, because... and this is the ways of attending thing, because I've disabled my ability to attend to the greater reality. I've lost my ability to know in this bigger sense. I mean, this is the thing, that certainty actually is an abstraction of reality. It's not what we really know there is not reality, but our representation of reality.
Yeah.
And that looks just, you know, we get so, it's sort of an illusion, you know, and in a way, I mean, there's a reason. I mean, of course, we certain circumstances we need to do that. But I've often said in this episode that in this podcast that the knowledge that we have of God is actually a more immediate kind of knowledge than scientific logical knowledge, because it's a matter of immediate experience. Mm. But that's difficult in our culture to sort of quantify.
Yeah, because
qualify.
Yeah, and a lot of the interviews I've watched with McGilchrist, it gets to a point. In the interview, you go, well, what do we do with this? You know, like you've articulated left and right. So what does that mean for us? How do we deal with it? You know, I find myself listening to someone like him and go, okay, so how do I distill this down into a framework of thinking?
Well, right. let's talk. I think this would be good
to
take this. You know, what do we do about this? Because I think we're all affected by our culture, and I think that's a really good question.
There's a good side and a bad side to that, because in the sense of that, as I find myself trying to figure out what is the framework, I feel like, oh, hang on a minute, am I trying to reduce it all down to parts?
Yeah.
Something that I can control?
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of like, well, so I'm kind of cautious to go, okay, here's the 5-point plan there for that. I move forward my life with this new bit of knowledge, you know.
Can I say from experience, I mean, this is the sort of stuff, that realizing a lot of this sort of stuff, and I think I started to realize before I got onto McGilchrist's work. I mean, I was sort of able to recognize and get to the roots of what this sort of, what was happening in this closed loop, and I realized that I actually need to exercise different ways of knowing than just this kind of logical closed loop way of knowing. But it is helpful to know when you get in that feedback loop of doubt, you know, is God really, and you start overthinking. And I think plenty of people know what I mean by that, because you're just overanalyzing things. And it's good to, first of all, recognize, this is happening. And actually, it has very limited value. And certainly, it has value. I mean, you know, let's not, because, you know, we need to try to explain things, but we need to also be able to diagnose in ourselves when that feedback loop is happening. And to do things to try to step out of that.
I'm probably, I don't know, I haven't done quite the reading you guys have done on this, but I understand some people tend to be more left brain and other people more right brain, whether that's true or not, I don't
know.
That's the stuff that he's, I think, trying to correct, because he's debunk. Saying we all use both sides of the brain. And yes, there are certain functions that use more.
But I would say for me, sitting like in meetings over my working career, I'm more of an intuitive thinker. Someone will present all the data to me, but I'll take that data back into my intuition. And sometimes I'll discard the data and go, nah, my gut says we're going here.
Yeah.
There are other people who it's the data and nothing else matters, you know. And I think
that's a good example.
And I think the point is that the data does need to come back. So you can send it away to get the analysis. Like imagine a marketing meeting, which is the things that I've sat in over many, many decades. People come with all the data, da 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 da. Now, if I just say, oh, well, that's it, then that's what the data says. Yeah. So that's what we do. And don't bring it back into what I know about the experience.
Yeah.
Then I'm making a decision based on ones and zeros,
not
actually on, but my experience tells me.
But yeah, it's a good example.
I think people are more dominant one side than the other, but I think the point is we need to rebalance that up, because one of the points he makes is those two hemispheres in our brain are actually like the same size. It's not that we're meant to be one or the other, but
it's how we access it, though.
But the person who thrives on that, maybe they you know, they're really kind of switched on to data more so than doing a painting, for example. But I think in both of those activities, well, if we take the data one, that you might be in a meeting and someone just wants the data and they run with it. Well, they actually need to get back to the right brain thinking, because you'll probably find those people are very dogmatic, black and white, probably lack some compassion and humility and things like that, more so than that get those kind of tendencies come out. So they actually need to take a step back and go, this is what the data is saying, but let's actually get back to kind of understanding other things.
Yeah.
It's more holistic, all of it fit together.
I mean, yeah. I feel like, you know, I've seen this effect in theological discussion a lot, because you get an approach to theology that's very kind of, theology gets abstract and it becomes the closed system, right? So people struggle with things like predestination and free will and get in the logical feedback loop, and they just cannot, and they are compelled to come up with an explanation that makes sense to the left brain, you know, whereas can't we just accept the paradox?
Yeah.
And I mean, there are famous paradoxes, you know, like the Achilles and the tortoise paradox, which is a classic left-right brain thing. You know, the left brain breaks reality into pieces, and so the paradox is that Achilles can never catch up with the tortoise because he has to cross half the distance, and then he breaks it down into increments. And if you break it down in increments, there are essentially an infinite number of increments between Achilles and the tortoise. That's if you break it into increments. And so logically, Achilles never catches up with the tortoise, even if he's faster, right? Now, that's a classic paradox created by the left brain, right? Because the right brain sees the wholeness of the situation and sort of intuits. No, he sort of does. This is where we end up in theological thinking. You know, we have these paradoxes that are essentially our, you know, logical brain trying to make sense of how this goes with this, and in a space-time sort of continuum. And whereas we're dealing with theology, which can't, it, you know, we've got to be careful that we recognize that theology is essentially our reception or reflecting on truths that, you know, come from an eternal, you know, eternal perspective. And so there's something, you know, important, I think, there for us to consider when we're thinking theologically.
Yeah.
But practically, let's get back to the practical.
One thing there too with Gugurus, he actually says he's very much focused on things like the sacred and the divine and so on, without necessarily having a theology behind it. And one of the things he did say was that he actually feels that the biblical Christianity actually is the thing that most closely resembles what aligns with how he understands it all. He's actually on board with a lot of the key ideas arriving at that from it. But he actually says the church is part of the problem in this, because we actually distill things down into.
Yeah, because even we do that. Yeah.
We take doctrinal statements and we make them black and white. Then we get all left brain about everything, and we just sort of grab hold of that, and we kind of make it that's, you know, we hold on to this dogma. And we lose the sense of awe and wonder and the ambiguity of what is in the divine that we can't ever possibly understand in any way. And actually our doctrinal statements are actually just a representation, a limited representation into something that's obviously much bigger that we can't actually grasp hold of. But one of the things he says about getting into the right brain, the way that we experience the right brain is we actually have to, I think he used the word get into the river. We actually have to get into it and be taken along by it rather than trying to control it. And I'm listening to this stuff and I'm going, wow, that is from a Christian perspective. That's right.
Yeah. And it doesn't devalue, you know, let's not devalue Christian doctrine and biblical truth.
Yeah.
But we've got to be careful that we don't treat it like a sort of exhaustive description of reality. It's so very important that we are, and I think, you know, I mean, I am fairly doctrinally particular, but not because I think it's an absolutely exhaustive perception of reality. It's because this is what God has revealed to us about reality. Mm-hmm. And we take that on faith, not as a sort of closed sort of intellectual system, but as a way of accessing you know, reality. It's a doorway or it's a window into mm-hmm. that reality, which is why you don't, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's why I think it's important not to change those things
well,
around.
It's like because, a fence, yeah. though. If we stay within the boundaries of that, we stay safe in terms of the knowledge that that we have. So,
well, it has practical effects. It's not the,
yeah. But yeah. it has practical, but it's like a fence that we put up. We're limited. We're limited in our understanding. Yeah. We're limited in language. We don't understand the nature of God, what it even means, the person of God and what's who God is and his nature and stuff. We've got yeah. glimpses of it and we've got things that kind of help us grasp hold of that in as much as what we need to yeah. in this life.
This is what we need to know. That's a yes. good way to put that. It's what we need to know.
Yeah.
And knowing that has a practical yeah. effect. So, you know, understanding who God is as he is revealed to us, you know, through scripture and ultimately through Christ is so important because there's a practical effect on how I relate to mm. God. But the point is we shouldn't take it as a closed scientific description. Mm. It's about enabling us. It gives us a filter through which we can rightly relate to God.
Mm.
Mm. You know, it's not just to be an abstract yeah. system. And I think this is why it's not enough just to know all of these truths in the abstract. We actually Friends. Have to access and mm. experience this reality and exercise ways of knowing that are going to move away from the left brain closed loop. And this is where I think, you know, the practice of worship, the role of music and worship and these mm. things that we do that I think sometimes in a left brain society think, oh, what's all this about? No, there's a temptation just to sort of stand there and look at the words and analyze what's going around us. No, get into the river, mm. like participate, mm. worship, like sing, actually, because singing is musical and activates that part of the brain that I think opens us. It's, you know, practicing the contemplative disciplines and reflecting and go for a walk into solitude or, you know, join other people, you know, pray and let your longings, you know, rise up mm. before God and relate to people, actually real people, have real relationships with real people, not mediated through information bits. It's real embodied relationships with other people that activates this capacity mm. within us. You're not only relating to other people as people, we need to be careful not relating to other people as objects. So work relationships are not enough. We've got a learning to love other people. Learning to love other people expands the capacity by which we then come to know God. This is the connection between these two things, because by learning to love people, we're exercising a certain capacity that expands then our capacity to actually know God. From there, the practices of worship and prayer, and particularly together with other people, this is where, you know, we talked in the last episode about how important our experience of what church is meant to be, how important that is, and the context that we create together in church, praying together, worshiping together, reflecting together, hearing from God together. These are the practices, I think, that are going to be the great corrective. And the more we lean into that, I think the more fully human we become and the more we will know God in the broader sense.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Thrive Perspectives. Our hope is that these discussions will challenge you to look at life from a new perspective. You'll find all our resources at the Thrive Today website, thrivetoday.tv. If there's a topic that you'd like us to discuss, please email us. Our email is contact@thrivetoday.tv. Until next time, our prayer is that you will thrive.